Radio.
Lee, who are you here for?
I am for you, Mike.
Are you insane?
They are insane!
In the hands of an adolescent, it is a cellular peptide cake.
Red Frosting.
It does like you.
Yes.
How you doing, Mike?
Here's Bob.
Whoops!
I want to give you a little context into my strategy for interviewing people, especially people from the original series. If you listen to some of these interviews, they're going to seem a little long-winded at times. They're a little rambling. And that's a little bit of the case of the interview we have coming up today with the lovely Miss Lee Merriweather. She starts off, she has a sort of a long story about how she got to be Miss America in 1955, which is a fascinating story, but it takes a good bit of time to rev up. Now, part of that is because of me. I started a new job last week, and she wanted to podcast at 2 o'clock on Wednesday, and I misread it. I thought it was Thursday, and so I had to run into another office and put on my earphones and just kind of do it. And that's why, like, you know, I couldn't hear it first. I had to get everything going, and it took me a little while to catch up. All right, that's on me. But I let some of these people kind of go and kind of talk for a couple reasons. One is that I have to imagine that they've been asked the same question for the past 50 years. What was it like to be on Star Trek? And perhaps sometimes only that. Perhaps that's the only thing they're asked. And to a person, they've all been wonderful about answering it. And I have the suspicion that they have many canned responses and canned stories. I think Lee had a really funny story about DeForest Kelly that she's going to tell. But I have a feeling she's told that many times before. It's her go-to. It's like her closer if she's doing stand-up comedy. And I get that. So what I want to do is I want to find out the other stories. I want to try and probe, the probe, right, from Star Trek IV. I want to probe and figure out if there's anything that everyone else has missed. So in order to do that, I want them to tell me all about themselves. I want them to start from whatever beginning they want to. And then we sort of ease our way into Star Trek to kind of make them comfortable. If the first thing I say is, oh, tell me about Lucira, and by the way, I mess up her name and call her Larissa. Ugh, so bad. But again, I was kind of caught flat-footed on this one. You know, if I just ask her, tell me about Lucira right off the bat, then she's going to be, okay, this is one of those interviews. I want her to feel comfortable. It's a Midwestern thing. I don't want to hit the thing too on the nose. I want her to feel comfortable. I want her to feel as though, like, this is a place where she can share whatever she wants. And so we have a long preamble until we hit Star Trek. I think it's probably like 20 minutes before we actually hit Star Trek. But that's okay, because that goes to the second point. The first point is strategy. The second point is more historical. The people we're talking to are not just finite points of Star Trek. They're not just, oh, they just did Star Trek, they moved on. Yes, this is a show about talking about Star Trek. But in addition, this is a show about talking to the people who made Star Trek, and what got them there, and what they did beyond. And I'm fascinated about these actors, and I hope to talk to some writers and directors at some point in time, whose lives have been suspended in amber because of this one moment. But what do they do before, and what do they do afterwards? I'm also fascinated with the whole convention circuit. I met her at Comic-Con, and she talks about going out to Connecticut. That's just such a fascinating, it's such a small subset of people who do that, who travel from place to place for their entire lives, the past 50 years, going to convention. It fascinates me. I don't know why, but I just find it incredibly fascinating. But I really enjoy talking to these people and figuring out who they are in their lives, what brought them up to Star Trek, and where they've gone before. And certainly with Lee, she has had a huge career, and we could not negate that for, you know, a guest star role, almost a co-star role, I would say. I mean, she's in she's in it, but she's not in this. Lee Merriweather, as we're talking, was Lucira from That Which Survives, third season episode, an okay third season episode. We can get into it sometime. A little creepy, a little fun, a good idea. Not executed the best, but not executed the worst. Had a nice little tag at the end. So I wanted to kind of get a feel for that, because she's done Catwoman. She was Catwoman. She was Lillian Munster in The New Munsters. She was so many cool different roles. She was in the 4D. Oh my God. She was in the 4D Man. a great old school horror film. And she's going to tell you a great story about that. You have to listen to that story. It's so weird. I want to give you the full palette and not just that little piece of their lives, because I think that's important. And if we did that, it'd only be like 5 minute long podcast. Plus, as I told you, I have a job. And if you listen closely, you can kind of suss out what I'm doing because I kind of tag it back to something she did in the 90s. So with... Oh, and one last thing. At the end of this, I'm going to stick on my friend Scott Hensel's rendition of a Klingon song. I think if you remember when we talked about By the Pale Moonlight in Inferno's Light. In Purgatory Shadow in Inferno's Sun. God, weird names. That there was a song that they were going to write for Worf and for the Doctor and for Garak. They were going to have them do that. Martok was going, we will write songs. I will get the best muse and Klingon to do that. And I think I asked Callie to do it, and she is not done. She's a busy person. She's a very busy person. But my friend Scott is not a busy person. And so he composed a Klingon song speaking about the wonderful things that Martok, Garak, Worf, and Bashir did while they were on that prison planet. And I'll play that at the end. It's weird. It's weird, but it's cool. So, without further ado, enjoy my interview with the lovely Lee Merriweather. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Good. My name's
How
Mike.
Are you?
I'm good. My name is Mike McCaffrey. Thanks so much for doing this. We had a brief conversation at the Comic-Con. I don't know if you remember that, because you only talked to one person there. Is that correct? Just me.
Yes.
But we had a great conversation. We were talking about all sorts of cool stuff. And I said, hey, can I talk to you on my podcast? And you said, sure. And now here we are. So I'm so excited. Thank you so much for joining me on this.
Oh, good. No, I'm glad. I love it.
Good.
It'll be fun.
Now, do you do a lot of these conventions? Because you were at Comic-Con, but you weren't at Star Trek convention. So do you do a lot of them, or...
No, I couldn't do that. I wanted to go to the Star Trek convention, but it was coincided with the Miss America pageant, which I go to every year.
Why do you go there? Is that a passion of yours, or?
No, I go back every year. I'm a former, now they're calling us forever Miss Americas. So.
What year were you a Miss America, if you don't mind me asking?
1955.
Oh my gosh. Wow, that's amazing. I saw you at Comic-Con, you were beautiful. I mean, you say that and I like that's a lie. That it can't be. It had to be like 1995 because you look great. I'm collapsing. You look fabulous. So how was the Miss America contest? Was that fun?
Oh, yes, it is. It's always fun when we go back. I take usually both my daughters to go back, and we just have a lot of fun there, and seeing all the girls, and it's just a fun time to catch up with other forevers, you know, seeing what they're doing.
Doesn't that sound like some sort of like warning? Like now you're a forever Miss America, like you can never like escape it.
Oh, exactly, because you know there's only one Miss America for 1955, and that's me. So that's why they started it forever Miss Americas, some former Miss Americas.
But it sounds like some sort of horrible curse, like they're going to put you in some sort of like museum and like, you know, like put you in wax or something, doesn't it? Like, oh, now you're this forever, Lee. You know, it's going to be terrifying, well, right?
Well, they have our pictures up all over the place in Atlantic City.
And, that's amazing.
It's a nice display, and it's beautiful and all that. So it's not horrible. Yeah.
No, it's not horrible. Are you kidding? Your picture's up there. That's amazing. Lee, where were you born? Where did you grow up in?
I was born in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow. Whereabouts?
In a hospital.
Excellent. Okay, thank you. That's our podcast, and good night. It's that simple.
I know, my mother once told me that I spoke sort of in a gibberish, but one of the first sentences that made sense when I was talking as I said, I live in a Yajo house in Sarnanjas.
In a Yajo house? What was that part?
So that would be yellow.
Oh, yellow
house. House in Los Angeles.
In Los Angeles.
But in my speaking of, well, let's see, I was probably 3 at that time, and speaking, so Yajo house in Sarnanjas is pretty good.
That's pretty good for 3. You did a pretty good job. I'm going to give you a lot of credit for that. So you were born in Los Angeles in a hospital, which you're not going to name. That's fine. I'm in Los Angeles right now as well, just so you know. And my kids were born in Los Angeles hospitals as well. So, you know, it's rare to find native Los Angelinos, don't you think?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I know you're absolutely right.
Have you lived here all your life?
No, I've lived in New York. When I was on the Today Show, after the pageant, I was asked to be their on-air women's editor. And so I did women's features on the Today Show for about a year and a half, 2 years. And and then I stayed on, and then they... Florence Henderson came in after me.
Okay.
And I got to live in New York for a while till I got married. And then my then husband, Frank Letter, got a series in Los Angeles. So we moved to Los Angeles.
You moved
and
back.
Been here ever since.
Okay. So did you always have like a dream of acting, or were you like, I want to do pageants and then something else?
Oh no, I didn't enter the pageant. I was entered by a fraternity.
What? A fraternity entered you?
Oh yeah. I would never have entered. I would never have entered, but because I knew nothing of the Miss America pageant except that it was like bathing beauties, and I was, you know, when you grow up with kids making fun of you at school, and you're skinny and flat-chested and blah, 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 and all that. You know, it's just not fun.
Yeah.
I would never, never have entered. But a fraternity actually has submitted my name because they didn't have a sister sorority. And I found out years later, it was an African-American fraternity.
Oh.
And so they didn't have a sister sorority, and they said, well, can we nominate somebody? And I said, yes, okay. I think what the pageant did, the Miss San Francisco pageant, they took it out of the hands of a fellow, I guess, who had run it for years, I don't know. But they turned it over to the Junior Chamber of Commerce. So they spread it out all over the Bay Area. To colleges and to high school seniors area, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Send us your girls. Send us, you know, we want to run this pageant, and they have to have talent and all that. And so it was just sheer luck that I found out that I was nominated. I ran into a young man I had gone to high school with, and I had record albums. I was carrying record albums, and I had to have this final in the radio class. I had to write, produce, direct, and find all the music, and direct the show in the radio class. And to get an A, I had to be really on top of my game. And I was walking with these albums because I had to listen to make sure that I've got the right kind of music at certain points in this hour-long thing that I'd written. And Jerry Chrisman stopped me outside the door of the studio, the radio studio, and he said, he looked at the albums, and he said, oh, you're not going to do a record pantomime, are you? I said, what? No, this is for my final, and you've got your music. And he said, no. I said, wait a minute, why did you say that, the San Francisco thing? And he said, well, you're nominated. You know, one of the fraternities nominated you. I said, But what? He said, you don't know anything about it? That's how I found out.
Wow. That's okay. So you did Miss San Francisco first, right?
Yes. Yes. Uh-huh.
And then that nominated you to go on to be Miss America.
It's a city, state. So I it was so funny because someone said after I won Miss San Francisco, I said, well, you've been going to Santa Cruz. And I said, is there an appearance there? And they said, no, dear, you're going to compete in the Miss California pageant as Miss San Francisco. I was so dense. I really was. I didn't know anything about it. I said, do I have to? And they said, yes, you definitely have to. And so I went and then I won there. And then unfortunately, my father passed away shortly after I became Miss California. And I just went into a funk. Depression set in. It was just awful. Just terrible. He was only 48 years old, you know, and really rough. And my mother was the one who pulled me out and up out of my depression. And she said, now listen, you know, your daddy will be there. We know he's here and there. And then we got a letter from the Miss America pageant because it filtered down, I think, from the pageant office in Santa Cruz that I wasn't going to be coming and that they would be sending a thing. And Lenora Slaughter, bless her heart, she was really the woman who brought the pageant up to where its standards are today. She worked from just the Bathing Beauties on the beach all the way up to it's the largest scholarship foundation for women in the world.
Oh, and that's wonderful.
Oh, yeah, it's fabulous. And so she wrote a lovely letter and saying, and unfortunately, if you don't come, you'll have to give back your scholarships that you've already won in Miss San Francisco and Miss California. And remember that you, just for coming to Atlantic City, we give you a stipend for coming to help you with the travel.
Oh.
And so my mother said, let's go. We'll do this. Daddy will be so pleased. And so I did. I did. And then the California people, several of the judges said, well, let's work on your talent and let's work on all this and everything. And they said, just remember that every Miss California has been in the top 10. And I said, well, what if I don't make? You will. And I was, well, but you will. So that was all I was hoping for when I went. Just please, please, please. I'd say prayer every night. Please, dear Lord, let me be in the top 10, not 10. And so when it happened, top 10, I said, oh, there, okay, that's it. And then, of course, you know, you have to answer questions at that time and different things. And the top five. And so I thought, now maybe I'll get a little scholarship more. That's wonderful. Okay, good. And then when they announced me, I had already known that I knew Ann Daniels, who was Miss Florida, was going to win. She was my partner throughout. We were always, we had one chaperone between us, and it was just, I knew she was going to win. And well, she came in second. But they put the banner on me, my lap, and I said, oh, should I pin it on her? Because she was sitting right next to me. And she said, and then Lenora Slaughter said, no, dear, this is yours.
I said, wow.
That's how I found out. It was back, and it was done backstage. So it was the first year of the telecast, but it wasn't until the second year that the audience
got to see you with that look of surprise.
They didn't see it. When they went home, their friends who said they were staying or whatever, you know, well, you should have seen the telecast because we saw this. And so, needless to say, they changed the format. And from then on, the crowning took place on stage so that the entire audience and the television audience will see it at the same time. So that was, it was kind of an interesting piece of history there.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. That's incredible. So that's sort of like, you sort of fell into this. You sort of fell into being Miss America. Like how, what is, like
oh,
you had,
definitely.
Just like, oh, I think I'll just be Miss America today. I think it sounds like a good thing. And then you did. That's amazing.
Yeah. No, and I felt it was an obligation that I wasn't comfortable with it, but when I met a lot of the girls in Atlantic City, some of them were so wonderful, and of course I already mentioned Ann Daniels, and she was just terrific, and so I spent most of my time with her, and we bonded, and it was just a really great, great time, and I got to know all the girls and wished them well. I picked out several. I thought Annie really was going to win because her talent was just incredible.
And yet it was destined for you.
And
it was for you as we're going to lead up to. I am for you, Lee Merriweather.
Oh.
See how I'm doing that? But before we go that, let's talk.
That's
so
very good.
that's why I have this big, huge podcast, Lee, where I have like over 100 people listening. So this is really big stuff. We have a few more than that. Let's move forward a little bit. So then you started to get into acting. You moved back to Los Angeles. You got into some acting. Is this correct? Mm-hmm. Was it something you're like, now I want to do this. You moved back to Los Angeles, or did people say, we want you to be in stuff?
Well, I had done a movie while I was living in New York. My first movie was The 4D Man.
Yep, starring Robert Lansing.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Also in Star Trek. You know, did you know that? He was also in Star Trek.
Yes. Uh-huh. I know.
Now that's a creepy movie.
A good friend, and his wife.
Oh, really?
Good. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He seems good. Now, hold on a second. We got to talk about that because I saw that as a kid, and that movie kind of creeped me out at the very end because he's a guy, he's a scientist, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And he creates this ability to be 4D, which means he moves through walls.
Exactly. Yes.
And but then he starts going crazy. Is that? Am I remembering it right?
Yes. It really did. He, in order to maintain the ability to walk through walls, he had to get a life source, and so he was killing people.
Oh God, that's great! I forgot about that. Yeah, mm-hmm. He like drinks their energy. And he's coming for you, isn't he? Like, isn't he coming for you at the end?
Just at the end, and I kill him. Yes.
You kill him. Wait, he dies.
Well,
in
I shot him, but he staggers and falls into the, I think the wall that was plutonium or I don't know.
And he can't go all the way through. So just like his arms are sticking out at the end. Is that right? That's what I remember.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I haven't seen it.
we should watch it together because all I remember, you're reminding me of this stuff, but all I remember is him like with his hands slowly coming through the plutonium and then he dies and his hands are like sticking out of the plutonium. Like, ooh, that's creepy and weird. So you creeped me out when I was a kid, Lee. I don't know if you know that, but that's. Thank you.
Sorry.
Thank you for terrifying me. No, it's fine. I love it. So you did that. Did you do that in New York or did you do it in Los Angeles?
No, we did it in Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania?
Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, how did that work out? How did you shoot a film in Pennsylvania?
Well, it was a film company that had made The Blob.
Oh,
and
so good.
So that, but it was a company that made religious films.
What?
And so they made The Blob and to make money so that they could make religious films.
It's like eating Peter to pay Paul, right?
Yes. It was an interesting situation. It was a very pleasant set, you know, and they always prayed before they filmed the day.
They
it's
prayed?
Really not.
That's amazing.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And then they said, oh, and okay, you know, so like, thanks be to God, and now, Robert, you're going to go kill this guy.
Yeah, well, in a way.
They
save that for later in the day.
did you ever talk to anyone and say, like, how do you reconcile this, that, like, you're doing this in the daytime and then, like, you're turning around making, like, Christian films? Like, was anyone, like, plussed by that, or?
No, they as a matter of fact, there were two films, I think they were, they're all told that they made three films and were able to produce them with the money that they made from The Blob and The 4D Man.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm looking it up right now. It says Jack Harris was the producer. Does that ring a bell?
Right. Yes, Jack Harris was the producer, and Shorty A was the director.
He's still alive. It says he's still alive. We should go visit him in Beverly Hills, it says. My goodness.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it says he's 97 years old. I mean.
Oh, my goodness.
We should stop by and say, you made The Blob and you made The 4D Man. What was going through your head at that point in time, right?
Oh, my. I didn't know. I haven't heard from him or anything over the years, but... it would be fun to talk to him.
Yeah. All right, but we're not talking about him. I'm sorry. We're talking about you. We're talking about you. And so you did that film out in Pennsylvania, and then you come up to L.A., and then do you start auditioning, or do you start getting offers? Because you've got a huge resume. How does that happen for you?
Well, I did. I got an agent. I had an agent, and he sent me out on jobs, and I got several of them, guest parts on various series.
Mm-hmm.
And had a lot of fun, had a lot of good roles, and then came I did Time Tunnel, the series.
Yeah,
I got the role. That's nice.
Irwin Allen TV show.
Yep.
Not as famous as Lost in Space, but pretty good premise.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. And with Bob Colbert and Jimmy Darren. And most of the time, I didn't work with them at all. I worked with John Zaremba and Whit Bissell all the time.
Because you were, like, lab, right? Were you, like,
They were just wonderful. I was working in the tunnel and keeping them... aligned so that they could come back, hoping to, or to send them off to someplace else.
Right. Yeah.
For next week's show.
Right. Can't lose you in 1855. You have to do another episode next week. NBC demands
exactly.
It.
And then I was very lucky in that Julie Newmar had got a film job, so she couldn't do the film of Batman, and they sent out citywide, send us your girls, the agent,
I've done that before.
And I walked into this room and I saw easily 100 women, just, I know, all gorgeous, all, voluptuous and all. And I thought, oh my gosh, they're not going to, oh well, I'll audition, I'm going to try for this. And they liked what I did with the reading in the office.
Wow.
It was just, luckily I had grown up with cats, so I knew how to move and they had a chair that was really terrific because it was soft and I needed it, and I licked my hand, my paw, and I was able to fake a pretty good Russian accent for part of her character. It was Kitka. Ketanya, Irenia, Tatanya, Karenska, Alice. My friends call me Kitka. I love playing her. I love playing that.
And that was 1966, I believe. Is that correct?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So it's, as we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, and we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of that Batman movie, which was phenomenal.
And I think you're also... 50th for Time Tunnel, too.
Is that right?
Around that.
Mm-hmm. You might be right. Let me see. Yeah, it says 1966, 1967. You're right. Well, of course, you're on it, so yeah. Happy anniversary. Happy time tunnel anniversary.
Thank you.
Now, you guys only went backwards in time in the time tunnel. Is that correct?
Yes. I was kidnapped in one of them, and I haven't seen it in such a long time. I can't remember.
Oh, that's all right.
I went into outer space. I know that. And was somewhere on another planet, I think.
Oh. Like, I have to watch more time tunnel. Sounds fabulous.
I think a guy in silver, all in silver, came and took me away.
That sounds like an Irwin Allen film, for sure. Guy in silver. We had
some great character actors come in and work on the show that came into the time tunnel part where I was. So I got to meet Victor Jory. I think it's all gone now. I'm looking at my finger. I had a scar for such a long time on my knuckle finger.
Oh.
My finger from him. He was very powerful, and he pushed me aside and used me as a protection from the, he just was very rough and caught my, I'm looking at it now, and I said, no, the scar is gone, not my finger.
Wow, so yeah. Time tunnel was dangerous. It's too bad, someone from the future, like your future self should have come and said, like, watch out for him. He's gonna rough you up there, right?
Exactly. That, if only.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Well, certainly the Batman. So you did a couple episodes of Batman as well. You did, like, the TV show as well as the movies. Is this correct?
I did one episode. They came because they came to me saying, you know, will you be Catwoman on the series? And I said, you know, I'm signed already to do Time Tunnel. That's what I'm doing. And they said, oh, okay. And so they went and they got Eartha Kitt. So that was their good fortune, because I thought she was wonderful.
Yeah. That. Well, you were wonderful too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's funny. It's you mentioned that because I remember seeing you speaking about your Catwoman days on a show called Space Ghost. Do you remember that?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Oh my gosh! I bet you everyone comes like, "Oh, I saw you in Space Ghost." Like, yes, I know. Do you remember? Did people talk to you about that at all, or no?
No, very few. Very few asked about it. No, it was so fast and so furious, and just in one day. I mean, I just was there. I didn't understand the concept, and I had never seen the show, so I didn't know what was happening, because a lot of it was done, I guess, afterwards, or electronically added, so I had no idea. I think I felt rather stupid, to tell you the truth, because I just didn't know what was happening.
No, it was great. You looked great. Have you ever seen it? Have you ever seen the finished product?
No.
Oh, you should see it. It's really great. Let me tell you, the funny thing about this is a weird bit of circular logic here, is that Space Ghost was created for a channel called Adult Swim. And as it happens, right now I'm sitting in one of the Adult Swim production offices.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yeah, so talking to you about what you did back in the 90s for this. You should watch it. It's very funny. It's a very funny little animated sequence. It's worth your time. And one of the cartoon characters thinks that Eartha Kitt is better, and the other guy, like, defends your honor quite admirably. So he's
really? Oh, yeah. For heaven's sake.
It's very wonderful.
And now, how do I find that?
I don't know. I think maybe you'd probably go, let me see, I'm going to type it in right now, Space Ghost Lee Merriweather. Just misspelled your name. I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
Oh, you can, if you type in Space Ghost Lee Merriweather, a YouTube video will pop up. You can watch it.
Oh, on YouTube. Okay. I'll have my daughter do it for me because I know I have a terrible time with
I'll send you the link. I'll email you the link. How about that?
Oh, that'd be great.
Yeah, it'll be great. So this is all, now Lee, this is, I mean, you know, we've gone through all this stuff and I've sort of teased around this, but you know why we're here. You know, we've got to talk a little bit about Star Trek, just a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
So you played the beautiful Larissa, Larissa, is that how we're saying it?
Larissa.
Yeah, I got that wrong. This is
Commander of the Calandrians.
Look at you know, it's because you've been asked this question a billion times before.
Oh yeah.
But let's subdivide a little bit. So, had you ever seen Star Trek before you auditioned for this?
Oh yes, and I didn't audition. They just called me, and I had the part. I didn't have to read for it or anything.
Okay.
It's interesting. That's the only time I never had to read for a part.
Is that right?
Yeah, I had the part going in. No.
See, Lee, I don't want to place anything, but I don't want to say you're leading a charmed life. You're leading this life where you are falling into fortune. Your life has been blessed, perhaps we'll say that. Don't you think?
Well,
I mean, like you fall into Miss America, and then, you know, you get in this great career and you're offered this role, which 50 years later, like, this dork is talking to you about.
I mean, you're not a dork.
Well, you haven't seen me, but that's, and you don't want to. There's no visual. I'll tell you this, but for it to be the only time you've ever been offered a role, that is fortuitous, don't you think? I mean,
it was thrilling that I just got it. They said yes, they want you, and da-da-ba-bum, and you report tomorrow for wardrobe and. Makeup and things, and then the next day we were filming.
Wow. Now, you said you'd seen the show before.
Yes, I had. I had seen it, sort of toward the beginning, and then because I was in a play, I missed several episodes
of
it, I'm sure. Because I, you know, there's no way I could watch.
Mm-hmm.
And so I missed out on the early ones, and I think pretty soon they're going to come out with, unless they've already done it, where they have all of them in a compendium, I mean, a box, like, well, a box set of Star Trek.
Oh, you can, yeah, you can get them on Netflix, you can get them all over the place. And if you get, yeah, and they're beautifully remastered. You know, they're in high definition. They took out all the film grain, all the scratches. It's beautiful. You should check it out.
I will.
Yeah. Because it's they did a really nice job, and including on your creepy effect where you've seen it, right? Where you like basically become like the 1D girl because you like. Essentially fold into a little line and then like disappear. It's so creepy, you know?
Yeah. And I loved what they did with it. Oh
yeah. Like that weird, like ethereal, you know, woman singing in the distance. It was a creepy one. So you get on set. So like you go through the costuming. Now was Gene Roddenberry there? I'd heard he wasn't there that much in the third season.
No, he really wasn't. I met him briefly, I think, in the hallway once. That's my memory of it. I have a feeling I've met him that I met him someplace else casually. I mean, it was like not on the set.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a dinner or something. Like a lot of people were there, and I was able to thank him then. That's been so long.
That's okay. So you just start passing by, and then you get your costume fitting, and then you show up the first day on set. What was that like? Just give me like was it just like, oh, another day, another soundstage, here I go?
Oh, no. It was really fabulous. Experience. I mean, the sets were wonderful. It was another planet, you know, kind of thing. I'm sure they refurbish it from another another time, but it was it was just exciting. It really was. I loved it, and it was funny because I was standing there. My costume was it was hip hugger time.
Yeah.
In fashion, you know. So I had hip huggers, and then, but you couldn't show the belly button at that time.
Of course.
So they had a flap that was up above, you know, hip huggers, and then it goes along and then up. It's hard to describe.
I remember. It does have that little kind of little square thing that came up on your belly button.
Right, over the belly button, right. Well,
that's so funny.
The one person that I really was looking forward to meeting was DeForest Kelly, because I had seen him in movies, and when I was growing up in Phoenix, Arizona, and on westerns, he made a couple of westerns, and I thought, oh, I'm really looking forward to meeting him, and he was just. One day, I think it was the first day. I really do think it was the first day. He came walking by me, and he pulled the flap down and asked me what time it was, and then flopped it back up, laughed, and walked on.
Oh.
And that was my meeting of the guy. Oh, and he's gone. And so I waited, and I waited, and I waited. Next day, no, he wasn't there. The next day he wasn't there, and the next day he wasn't there, and finally the fourth day or thereabouts, I waited and I stood there, and he came by me and pulled it down again and said, "What time is it?" And he went like that, because I had been gluing a clock face into my belly button every day, waiting for him to do it again. And he did. He dropped to his knees, laughed hysterically, and he said, "Oh, you got me! You got me!" No, it was wonderful.
Oh, that's great! What a great story! Wow! And so, did you talk to him afterwards? Was he like, "Hey, that's great," and you know, and like he was?
Oh,
cool?
No, not really. He was busy. He had a scene to do, and he was off and running almost, but. He loved it. He thought it was very funny, and thanked me the last day for being brave enough to do it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. So in addition to DeForest, you got to work with Bill Shatner and George Takei. How were they on set? Were they nice? Were they all business?
Oh, very nice and very pleasant, very easy to work with. Mm-hmm. The work ethic on that show was wonderful. There was no fooling around. I mean, I was the only one that did any fooling around anyway with my flap, but that was just so brief, and nobody knew what was happening. So that was, and I didn't interrupt any filming, so I was lucky. And it was a conscientious set. It really was. They had work to do. You could feel it. You could feel it that this is something that's really exciting, and it's. You know, forefront heading outer space, you know, it's all that kind of, it was an energy on the set.
Yeah.
It was an energy there that, it was exciting that it was going to be a hit, and go and continue and all of that. And it has.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So here we are. Talk a little bit about Lucira. You know, the episode's fine. It's a third season episode, which generally I kind of derided because they cut the budget. Gene Roddenberry wasn't around. they had a showrunner who didn't quite understand the show. But this one kind of sticks out as being kind of a cool, creepy episode. And then at the end, you know, because you could have just been just a computer hologram, but at the end you have this beautiful speech about you and your people, which is so moving. It's such a great twist on what was going on.
Yes.
Talk
I
to
love
me.
That.
Like, did you do any work on this, or was it just like, I have to say these lines? I mean, did you understand what was going on with this character?
No, that was the key to the character for me, that speech. And I didn't want to kill, but had to, because the computer was using my image. I was long dead.
Yeah.
You know, and so, but it was, there was enough of my humanity left in that I didn't want to, but I had to, kind of thing. And that was hard to play, but I think it worked. No one said anything, and I know the directors said, "That's you're doing so great, so great. I don't want to touch it," and walked away.
That's good. When they walk away, you don't have to worry about it. Wow, that's great. That's so cool. It was. It was such a touching moment that this commander, you know, she was the last person alive, and so she sends out this warning, you know, to defend the outpost. I don't know what she was defending it for, but like as a warning to other people to stay away, you know, there's such a nobility to that person, and I think you really had that, you really kind of embraced that, and even in your holograms. You can see that reticence, like, I must touch you. I must touch you. You know, we're all going, what the hell's going on here?
I am for you.
Creepy. You're like, you're like a super attractive, like vampire with like, like inappropriate, like gestures. I need to touch you. Like, no, personal space, right? Like, you know, 2016, we can't do that. Right. It would be like, oh, we'd have boundaries. Talk to me. So, I mean, you know, we could go on and on about your career for years and years because you've been doing it for 50 years.
Years.
You know, we could touch on you doing the Munsters. You did Metal Gear Solid. I mean, all these incredible things. But talk to me a little bit about the legacy of doing this. I mean, it was a guest star role, and here we are 50 years later. How is that? Do you feel, and this is a long question, do you feel in some ways cheated because that's all people want to talk to you about, or do you feel like, wow, this is a great thing to be a part of?
Oh, no, I don't feel, I'm thrilled that people want to talk about it, you know, or listen to stories about it and all. And the other shows that I've done, a lot of them didn't gain the popularity of Star Trek, but that's, you know, they're out there. I guess people could probably find them, but I don't worry about it. I mean, I enjoy it when people come up, and I just came back from another convention in Cincinnati.
Oh, wow.
And the people just were marvelous. I mean, they tell me stories, and this time, more than any other, were people with wanting a Barnaby Jones picture, and telling me that they watched it with their grandparents.
Wow.
Or with their father, or, you know, it was a family. Families were watching that Barnaby Jones.
Yeah.
I've had that a couple of times, but this was quite a lot of what they came up with, you know. And, of course, Catwoman was fun and all that, and they talked to me about that. It's just, I've been really very lucky. all through my life. I really have. Knock wood.
Well, let me flip that and say we have been lucky that you have been in our lives. Because, see, that's why they, see, that's why I get paid no money to do this, Lee, is because I make these things up. Gosh, well, Lee, I don't want to take any more of your time. This has been fabulous. This has been a double dose of excitement, you know, with Catwoman, with Locira, with Barnaby Jones, all these great things. And is there something we should... I see you have a website, leemeriweather.com.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got it.
Is there anything else you want to plug? Anything you're doing that we need to look for you coming up? Or?
Well, I've done a lot of independent films. Mm. That's when SAG-AFTRA allowed us to work below the scale so that we could help fledgling directors and cinematographers and screenwriters to get a hold, you know, a foothold into the business. And that's what I've been doing recently. And I just, I wish that they had areas where you could go and see these films. Because I guess they have festivals. I do know they have festivals. I did win a Best Actress Award, as a matter of fact, which I'm waiting desperately for the director to give me my plaque and my money.
Oh, well.
because it was a monetary prize as well.
Oh, get that guy. Yeah. Dude owes you money, man.
It wasn't much, but I mean, it was nice, you know, that, you know, it'll buy me lunch.
Lee, if you need any help getting that, I know a couple guys. Me and them, we could stop by his house and just, you know, kind of give him a little, you know.
Okay.
You can say I am for money. That's why I can hold out my hand and say I am for money, and he's like, oh, I totally get that, and he'll give us the money.
Oh, Mike, you're funny. Great.
Oh well, Lee, thanks so much for doing this. I so appreciate this.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Could we end it like, you know, you saying like, if I ask you, who are you here for? Could you tell me who you're here for, and it be me? Can we do that? Like, I don't want to, like, if I say, Lee, who are you here for?
I am for you, Mike.
Oh, my God. That just freaked me out. That was so good, Lee. Oh, my gosh. There needs to be a sequel. I'm going to direct it. We're gonna do it in my garage, all right? I'll give you the time and place. that which still survives. That's which survivored. Lee, thank you so much, and have a great day. And
thank you. You too.
And I hope to talk to you again soon.
Okay. Good enough.
Okay. All right.
You
bye.
Take care. All righty.
Oh,
bye.
My. The Catwoman kiss. I love it.
No, Nico, Lyra, no,
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island, yeah, and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
And it might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you in Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you